Lewis. Lewis had been expecting such a call. He loved the laboratory more than he loved anyone or anything, and he had the full confidence of Welch, Theobald Smith, and Flexner. Lewis had won their confidence by his extraordinary performance as a young scientist under each of them in turn. He had already achieved much, and he held the promise of much more. He also knew his own worth, not in the sense that it made him smug, but in that it gave him responsibility, making his promise at least as much burden as ambition. Only an offer to become the founding head of the new Henry Phipps Institute. Phipps had made millions at U.S. Steel with Andrew Carnegie, then, like Carnegie, had become a prominent philanthropist, which was associated with the University of Pennsylvania, had lured him to Philadelphia from the Rockefeller Institute. He was modeling Phipps after the Institute, although Phipps would focus much more narrowly on lung disease, particularly tuberculosis. No one needed to tell Lewis the urgency of the situation. He knew the details of the British sailors who had died in early July, and he had very likely tried to culture bacteria from them and prepare a serum. Soon after learning that influenza had appeared in the Navy Yard, Lewis arrived there. It was up to him to take charge of what would normally be the step-by-step, deliberate process of tracking down the pathogen and trying to develop a serum or vaccine. And there was no time for normal scientific procedures. The next day, 87 sailors reported ill. By September 15th, while Lewis and his assistants worked in labs at Penn and at the Navy Hospital, the virus had made 600 sailors and Marines sick enough to require hospitalization, and more men were reporting ill every few minutes. The Navy Hospital ran out of beds. The Navy began sending ill sailors to the Pennsylvania Hospital at 8th and Spruce. On September 17th, five doctors and 14 nurses in that civilian hospital suddenly collapsed. None had exhibited any prior symptoms whatsoever. One moment, they felt normal. The next, they were being carried in agony to hospital beds. Navy personnel from Boston had been transferred elsewhere as well. As Philadelphia was erupting, so was the Great Lakes Naval Training Station, 32 miles above Chicago. Teddy Roosevelt had created the base in 1905, declaring that it would become the largest and best naval training station in the world. With 45,000 sailors, it was the largest, and it had begun to generate a proud history. The Seabees, naval construction battalions, were born there, and during the war, Lieutenant John Philip Sousa created 14 regimental bands there. Sometimes all 1,500 musicians played en masse on Ross Field, a spectacle for tens of thousands who flocked to hear them. As the influenza virus swept through the base, there would be no massing of anyone, musicians or otherwise. At this base, influenza ripped through the barracks very much like an explosion. Robert St. John had just been inducted into the Navy there when he became one of the early victims. Given a cot in a drill hall where soon thousands of men, in that one hall, would lie unattended, he later recalled, "No one ever took our temperatures, and I never even saw a doctor." He did make his first friend in the Navy, a boy on the next cot who was too ill to reach for water. St. John himself barely had the strength to help him drink from his canteen. The next morning, an orderly pulled the blanket over his friend's head, and two sailors put the body on a stretcher and carried it away. By then, the medical department had already reported that 33 caskets to Naval Medical Supply Depot required. They would soon require far more than that. One nurse at Great Lakes would later be haunted by nightmares. The wards had 42 beds. Boys lying on the floor on stretchers waited for the boy on the bed to die. Every morning, the ambulances arrived and stretcher bearers carried sick sailors in and bodies out. She remembered that at the peak of the epidemic, the nurses wrapped more than one living patient in winding sheets and put toe tags on the boy's left big toe. It saved time, and the nurses were utterly exhausted. The toe tags were shipping tags, listing the sailor's name, rank, and hometown. She remembered bodies stacked in the morgue from floor to ceiling, like cordwood. In her nightmares, she wondered what it would feel like to be that boy who was at the bottom of the cordwood in the morgue. The epidemic was sweeping through the Philadelphia naval installations with comparable violence, as it had in Boston. Yet in Philadelphia, despite the news out of Boston, despite the Great Lakes situation, despite events at its own Navy Yard, Philadelphia Public Health Director Wilmer Crewson had done absolutely nothing. Not all the city's public health figures remained oblivious to the threat. The day after the first sailor fell ill, Dr. Howard Anders, a prominent public health expert who despised and had no faith in the VAERS machine, wrote Navy Surgeon General William Braisted to ask, would the Navy federal authorities directly come in under this threat of influenza invasion and insist upon safeguarding its men and collaterally the whole population of Philadelphia? Braisted declined. Crewson publicly denied that influenza posed any threat to the city. He seemed to believe that, for he made no contingency plans in case of emergency, stockpiled no supplies, and compiled no lists of medical personnel who would be available in an emergency, even though 26% of Philadelphia's doctors and even a higher percentage of nurses were in the military. Indeed, despite building pressure from Lewis, from Anders, from physicians all over the city, from faculty at Penn and Thomas Jefferson Medical College, which refused to release six doctors who wanted to volunteer for military service just as the epidemic erupted, not until September 18th, a full week after the disease appeared in the city, did Crewson even schedule a meeting with Plummer, Lewis, and several others. In Crewson's fifth-floor office at City Hall, they acquainted each other with the facts. In Massachusetts, nearly 1,000 had already died, with tens of thousands ill, and the Massachusetts governor had just issued a plea for doctors and nurses from neighboring regions. In Philadelphia, hundreds of sailors were hospitalized. Few signs of disease had surfaced among civilians, but Lewis reported that as yet his research had not found an answer. Even if Lewis succeeded in making a vaccine, it would take weeks to produce in sufficient quantities. Thus, only drastic action could prevent the spread of influenza throughout the city. Banning public meetings, closing businesses and schools, imposing an absolute quarantine on the Navy Yard and on civilian cases. All these things made sense. A recent precedent existed. Only 3 years earlier, Crewson's predecessor, during the single term of the reform mayor, had imposed and enforced a strict quarantine when a polio epidemic had erupted, a disease Lewis knew more about than anyone in the world. Lewis certainly wanted a quarantine. But Plummer was Lewis's commanding officer. He and Crewson wanted to wait. Both feared that taking any such steps might cause panic and interfere with the war effort. Keeping the public calm was their goal. Those polio restrictions had been imposed when the country wasn't fighting a war. The meeting ended with nothing decided except to monitor developments. Crewson did promise to start a mass publicity campaign against coughing, spitting, and sneezing. Even that would take days to organize. And it would conflict with the downplaying of danger by Crewson and Navy officials. In Washington, Gorgas, who likely had heard from Lewis, was unsatisfied with these developments. By then, influenza had erupted in two more cantonments, Camp Dix in New Jersey and Camp Meade in Maryland, that sandwiched the city. Lewis was in very close contact with the Philadelphia Tuberculosis Society, and Gorgas asked it to print and distribute 20,000 large posters warning of influenza and stating a simple precaution that might help in at least a small way. When obliged to cough or sneeze, always place a handkerchief, paper napkin, or fabric of some kind before the face. Meanwhile, the Evening Bulletin assured its readers that influenza posed no danger, was as old as history, and was usually accompanied by a great miasma, foul air, and plagues of insects, none of which were occurring in Philadelphia. Plummer assured reporters that he and Crewson would confine this disease to its present limits, and in this we are sure to be successful. No fatalities have been recorded among Navy men. No concern whatever is felt by either the military and naval physicians or by the civil authorities. The next day, two sailors died of influenza. Crewson opened the municipal hospital for contagious diseases to the Navy, and Plummer declared, "The disease has about reached its crest. We believe the situation is well in hand. From now on, the disease will decrease." Crewson insisted to reporters that the dead were not victims of an epidemic. He said that they had died of influenza, but insisted it was only old-fashioned influenza or grip. The next day, 14 sailors died. So did the first civilian, an unidentified Italian at Philadelphia General Hospital at South 34th and Pine. The following day, more than 20 victims of the virus went to a morgue. One was Emma Snyder. She was a nurse who had cared for the first sailors to come to Pennsylvania Hospital. She was 23 years old. Crewson's public face remained nothing but reassuring. He now conceded that there were a few cases in the civilian population and said that health inspectors were looking for cases among civilians to nip the epidemic in the bud. But he did not say how. On Saturday, September 21st, the Board of Health made influenza a reportable disease, requiring physicians to notify health officials of any cases they treated. This would provide information about its movement. For the board to act on a Saturday was extraordinary in itself, but the board nonetheless assured the city that it was fully convinced that the statement issued by Director Crewson that no epidemic of influenza prevails in the civil population at the present time is absolutely correct. Moreover, the board feels strongly that if the general public will carefully and rigidly observe the recommendations to avoid contracting the influenza, an epidemic can successfully be prevented. The board's advice: stay warm, keep the feet dry and the bowels open. This last piece of advice, a remnant of the Hippocratic tradition. The board also advised people to avoid crowds. 7 days later, on September 28th, a great Liberty Loan parade, designed to sell millions of dollars of war bonds, was scheduled. Weeks of organizing had gone into the event, and it was to be the greatest parade in Philadelphia history, with thousands marching in it and hundreds of thousands expected to watch it. These were unusual times. The Great War made them so. One cannot look at the influenza pandemic without understanding the context. Wilson had realized his aims. The United States was waging total war. Already 2 million U.S. troops were in France. It was expected that at least 2 million more would be needed. Every element of the nation, from farmers to elementary school teachers, was willingly or otherwise enlisted in the war. To Wilson, to Creel, to his entire administration, and for that matter to allies and enemies alike, the control of information mattered. Advertising was about to emerge as an industry. J. Walter Thompson, his advertising agency was already national, and his deputy became a senior Creel aide, was theorizing that it could engineer behavior. After the war, the industry would claim the ability to sway the ideas of whole populations, while Herbert Hoover said, "The world lives by phrases," and called public relations an exact science. Total war requires sacrifice, and good morale makes sacrifices acceptable, and therefore possible. The sacrifices included inconveniences in daily life. To contribute to the war effort, citizens across the country endured the meatless days during the week, the one wheatless meal every day. All these sacrifices were, of course, voluntary, completely voluntary, although Hoover's Food Administration could effectively close businesses that did not voluntarily cooperate. And if someone chose to go for a drive in the country on a gasless Sunday, when people were voluntarily refraining from driving, that someone was pulled over by hostile police. The Wilson administration intended to make the nation cohere. Wilson informed the head of the Boy Scouts that selling bonds would give every scout a wonderful opportunity to do his share for the country under the slogan, "Every Scout to Save a Soldier." Creel's 150,000 four-minute men, Those speakers who open virtually every public gathering, including movie and vaudeville shows, inspired giving. And when inspiration alone failed, other pressures could be exerted. The preservation of morale itself became an aim. For if morale faltered, all else might as well. So free speech trembled. More than in the McCarthy period, more than during World War II itself, more than in the Civil War, when Lincoln was routinely vilified by opponents, free speech trembled indeed. The government had the 200,000 members of the American Protective League who reported to the Justice Department's new internal security agency headed by J. Edgar Hoover and spied on neighbors and co-workers. Creel's organization advised citizens, call the bluff of anyone who says he has inside information. Tell him that it's his patriotic duty to help you find the source of what he's saying. If you find a disloyal person in your search, give his name to the Department of Justice in Washington and tell them where to find him. Socialists, German nationals, and especially the radical unionists in the International Workers of the World got far worse treatment. The New York Times declared, the IWW agitators are in effect, and perhaps in fact, agents of Germany. The federal authorities should make short work of these treasonable conspirators against the United States. The government did just that, raiding union halls, convicting nearly 200 union men at mass trials in Illinois, California, and Oregon, and applying relentless pressure against all opponents. In Philadelphia, on the same day that Crewson first discussed influenza with Navy officials, five men who worked for the city's German-language paper, Tageblatt, were imprisoned. What the government didn't do, vigilantes did. There were the 1,200 IWW members locked in boxcars in Arizona and left on a siding in the desert. There was IWW member Frank Little, tied to a car and dragged through streets in Butte, Montana, until his kneecaps were scraped off, then hung by the neck from a railroad trestle. There was Robert Prager, born in Germany, but who had tried to enlist in the Navy, attacked by a crowd outside St. Louis, beaten, stripped, bound in an American flag, and lynched because he uttered a positive word about his country of origin. And after that mob's leaders were acquitted, there was the jurors' shout, I guess nobody can say we aren't loyal now. Meanwhile, a Washington Post editorial commented, in spite of excesses such as lynching, it is a healthful and wholesome awakening in the interior of the country. Socialist Eugene Debs, who in the 1912 presidential election had received nearly 1 million votes, was sentenced to 10 years in prison for opposing the war. And in an unrelated trial, Wisconsin Congressman Victor Berger was sentenced to 20 years for doing the same. The House of Representatives thereupon expelled him, and when his constituents re-elected him anyway, the House refused to seat him. All this was to protect the American way of life. Few elites in America enjoyed more luxuries than did Philadelphia society, with its Biddles and Whartons. Yet the Philadelphia Inquirer reported approvingly that at a dinner on the main line a dozen men were gathered at the table, and there was some criticism of the way the government was handling things. The host rose and said, Gentlemen, it is not my business to tell you what to say, but there are 4 Secret Service agents here this evening. It was a tactful way of putting a stop to conversation for which he did not care. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary William McAdoo believed that during the Civil War, the government had made a fundamental error not selling bonds to average citizens. Any great war must necessarily be a popular movement. It is a crusade, and like all crusades, it sweeps along on a powerful stream of romanticism. Lincoln's Treasury Secretary Salmon Chase did not attempt to capitalize the emotions of the people. We went direct to the people, and that means to everybody. To businessmen, workmen, farmers, bankers, millionaires, schoolteachers, laborers. We capitalized on the profound impulse called patriotism. It is the quality of coherence that holds a nation together. It is one of the deepest and most powerful of human motives. He went still further and declared, "Every person who refuses to subscribe or who takes the attitude of let the other fellow do it is a friend of Germany, and I would like nothing better than to tell it to him to his face. A man who can't lend his government $1.25 a week at the rate of 4% interest is not entitled to be an American citizen." The Liberty Loan campaign would raise millions of dollars in Philadelphia alone. The city had a quota to meet. Central to meeting that quota was the parade, scheduled for September 28th. Several doctors, practicing physicians, public health experts at medical schools, infectious disease experts, urged Crewson to cancel the parade. Howard Anders tried to generate public pressure to stop it, telling newspaper reporters the rally would spread influenza and kill. No newspaper quoted his warning. Such a comment might, after all, hurt morale. So he demanded of at least one editor that the paper print his warning that the rally would bring together a ready-made inflammable mass for a conflagration. The editor refused. Influenza was a disease spread in crowds. Avoid crowds was the advice Crewson and the Philadelphia Board of Health gave. To prevent crowding, the Philadelphia Rapid Transit Company had just limited the number of passengers in streetcars. Army camps had already become so overwhelmed by influenza that on September 26th, Provost Marshal Enoch Crowder canceled the next scheduled draft call. That same day, Massachusetts Governor Samuel McCall formally pleaded for federal help and for doctors, nurses, and supplies from neighboring states. If influenza was only beginning its assault on Philadelphia, it was already roaring full speed through the Navy Yard. 1,400 sailors were now hospitalized with the disease. The Red Cross was converting the United Service Center at 22nd and Walnut into a 500-bed hospital for the sole use of the Navy. Crewson saw those reports and heard from those who wanted to cancel the parade, all right, but he did not seem to be listening. All he did was forbid the entertainment of soldiers or sailors by any organization or private party in the city. But military personnel could still visit stores, ride streetcars, go to vaudeville shows or moving picture houses. In Philadelphia on September 27th, the day before the parade, hospitals admitted 200 more people, 123 of them civilians, suffering from influenza. Crewson felt intense and increasing pressure to cancel the parade. Pressure coming from colleagues in medicine, from the news out of Massachusetts, from the fact that the Army had canceled the draft. The decision whether to proceed or not was likely entirely his own. Had he sought guidance from the mayor, he would have found none. For a magistrate had just issued an arrest warrant for the mayor, who was now closeted with his lawyer, distracted and impossible to reach. Earlier, for the good of the city and the war effort, an uneasy truce had been forged between the Wehrmachine and the city's elite. Now, Mrs. Edward Biddle, president of the Civic Club, married to a descendant of the founder of the Bank of the United States, resigned from a board the mayor had appointed her to, ending that truce, adding to the chaos in City Hall. Crewson did hear some good news. Paul Lewis believed he was making progress in identifying the pathogen, the cause of influenza. If so, work on a serum and a vaccine could proceed rapidly. The press headlined this good news, although it did not report that Lewis, a careful scientist, was unsure of his findings. Crewson declared that the Liberty Loan Parade and associated rallies would proceed. None of the anxiety of the moment was reported in any of the city's five daily papers, and if any reporter questioned either Crewson or the Board of Health about the wisdom of the parade's proceeding, no mention of it appeared in print. On September 28th, marchers in the greatest parade in the city's history proudly stepped forward. The paraders stretched at least 2 miles, 2 miles of bands, flags, Boy Scouts, women's auxiliaries, Marines, sailors, and soldiers. Several hundred thousand people jammed the parade route, crushing against each other to get a better look, the ranks behind shouting encouragement over shoulders and past faces to the brave young men. It was a grand sight indeed. Crewson had assured them they were in no danger. The incubation period of influenza is 24 to 72 hours. 2 days after the parade, Crewson issued a somber statement. The epidemic is now present in the civilian population and is assuming the type found in naval stations and cantonments. To understand the full meaning of that statement, one must understand precisely what was occurring in the army camps. Chapter 18. Devens had been struck by surprise. The other cantonments and navy bases were not. Gorgas' office had issued immediate warnings of the disease, and medical staffs around the country took heed. Even so, the virus reached first and with most lethality into these military posts, invading the close cluster of young men in their barracks beds. Camp Grant was neither the worst hit nor the least. Indeed, except for one particular and individual tragedy, it was quite typical. The camp sprawled across rolling but mostly level country on the Rock River outside Rockford, Illinois. The soil there was rich and lush, and its first commandant had planted 1,500 acres on the base with sweet corn and hog corn, hay, wheat and winter wheat, potatoes and oats. Most recruits there came from northern Illinois and Wisconsin, farm boys with straw-colored hair and flushed cheeks who knew how to raise the crops and produce them in plenty. It was a remarkably orderly place, given the haste with which it had been built. It had neat rows of wooden barracks, and more rows and rows of large barrack tents, 18 men to each. All the roads were dirt, and in the late summer dust filled the air, except when rain turned the roads to mud. The hospital was situated at one end of the camp and had 2,000 beds, although the most patients it had cared for at one time was 852. Several infirmaries were also scattered throughout the base. In June 1918, Welch, Cole, Russell, and Richard Pierce of the National Research Council, who rarely left Washington, usually being too busy coordinating research efforts, had inspected the camp and come away impressed. Welch judged Grant's chief medical officer, Lieutenant Colonel H.C. Mikey, capable and energetic, the hospital laboratory excellent, the pathologist a good man, while Joe Capps, a friend of Cole, was of course an excellent chief of service at the hospital itself. The veterinarian, who was responsible for several hundred horses and assorted livestock, had also impressed them favorably. During that June visit, they had all discussed pneumonia. Capps had started clinical experiments with a serum developed by Preston Kyes that differed from Cole's. Kyes was a promising University of Chicago investigator, of whom Welch had said, "It is worthwhile for us to keep our eye on him." Capps and Cole exchanged information. Capps also spoke of seeing a disturbing trend toward a different type of pneumonia, clinically more toxic and fatal. At autopsy, often massive areas of consolidation, and also areas of hemorrhagic alveoli. Then he demonstrated for them an innovation he had experimented with, the wearing of gauze masks by patients with respiratory disease. Welch called the mask a great thing, an important contribution in prevention of spray infections. He encouraged Capps to write an article for the Journal of the American Medical Association and advised Pierce to conduct studies of the mask's effectiveness. Cole agreed. This is a very important matter in connection with the prevention of pneumonia. Welch also came away from that inspection, the last one of that tour, recommending two things. It confirmed in him his desire to have new arrivals at all camps assigned for 3 weeks to specially constructed detention camps. These men would eat, sleep, drill, and be quarantined together to avoid any cross-infections with men already in camp. Second, he wanted Capps's use of masks extended to all camps. Capps did write the JAMA article. He reported finding the masks so successful that after less than 3 weeks of experimenting, he had abandoned testing and simply started using them as a routine measure. He also made the more general point that one of the most vital measures in checking contagion is eliminating crowding. Increasing the space between beds in barracks, placing the head of one soldier opposite the feet of his neighbor, stretching tent flags between beds, and suspending a curtain down the center of the mess table are all of proved value. To prevent a few arriving individuals from infecting an entire camp, he also repeated Welch's recommendation to isolate transferred troops. Grant had such a depot brigade, a separate quarantine barracks for new recruits and transfers. Its stairways were built on the outside so guards could enforce the quarantine. But officers did not stay in the depot brigade. Only enlisted men did. Capps's article appeared in the August 10, 1918 issue of JAMA. On August 8th, Colonel Charles Hagedorn took command of Camp Grant. A short, brooding officer and a West Point graduate, still a bachelor at 51 years of age, he had devoted his life to the Army and his men. He had also prepared for war all his life, studying it constantly and learning from experience as well as reading and analysis. One report accredited him one of the most brilliant line experts of the regular army. He had fought the Spanish in Cuba, fought guerrillas in the Philippines, and chased Pancho Villa in Mexico just a year before. Sometimes he gave what seemed impulsive and even inexplicable orders, but they had a curve of reason behind them. He was determined to teach his soldiers to survive and to kill, not to die. He cared about his troops and liked being surrounded by them. One problem that confronted him seemed to have little to do with war. The camp was over capacity. Only 30,000 troops had been present when Welch had visited in June. Now the strength was in excess of 40,000, with no expectation of any decrease. Many men were forced into tents, and winter in northern Illinois, 1 year after a record cold, was only a few weeks away. Army regulations defined how much space each soldier had in the barracks. These regulations had little to do with comfort and much to do with public health. In mid-September, Hagedorn decided to ignore the Army regulations on overcrowding and move even more men from tents into barracks. Already the nights were cold, and they would be more comfortable there. But by then, Gorgas's office had issued warnings about the epidemic, and influenza had reached the Great Lakes Naval Training Station 100 miles away. At Camp Grant, doctors watched for the first case. They even had an idea where it might occur. Dozens of officers had just arrived from Devens. The camp senior medical staff confronted Hagedorn over his plan to increase crowding. Although no record exists of the meeting, these physicians were men whom Welch and Cole held in the highest regard, and in outstanding civilian careers, they gave rather than took orders. The meeting had to have been contentious. For God's sake, they would have warned him, scattered cases of influenza had already appeared in Rockford. But Hagedorn believed that disease could be controlled. In addition to his combat record, he had been chief of staff in the Canal Zone and had seen Gorgas control even tropical diseases there. Besides, he had tremendous confidence in his medical staff. He had more confidence in his doctors than they had in themselves, perhaps reminding them they had avoided even the measles epidemic that had plagued so many cantonments. On September 4th, the camp's own epidemiologist had filed a report noting, "The epidemic diseases at this camp were at no time alarming. Cases of measles, pneumonia, scarlet fever, diphtheria, meningitis, and the smallpox occurred sporadically. None of these diseases ever assumed epidemic form." And this was only influenza. Still, Hagedorn made a few concessions. On September 20th, he issued several orders to protect the camp's health. To prevent the rise of dust, all roads would be oiled. And out of concern for influenza, he agreed to a virtual quarantine. Until further notice from these headquarters, passes and permission to be absent from camp will not be granted to officers or enlisted men, except from this office, and then only for the most urgent reasons. But he issued one more order that day as well. It must have been particularly galling for Mikey and Caps to see him use their authority to justify it. There must, as a military necessity, be a crowding of troops. The camp surgeon, under the circumstances, authorizes a crowding in barracks beyond the authorized capacity. This will be carried out at once as buildings are newly occupied. September 21st, the day after Hagedorn issued his order, several men in the Infantry Central Officers Training School, the organization with officers from Devens, reported ill. They were immediately isolated in the base hospital. It did little good. By midnight, 108 men from the infantry school and the unit next to it were admitted to the hospital. There, each patient had a gauze mask placed over his mouth and nose. The two units were isolated from the rest of the camp, and men in the units were partly isolated from each other. Every bed had sheets hung around it, and twice a day each man was examined. All public gatherings, movies, YMCA functions and the like were canceled, and the men were ordered not to mingle in any manner with men of other organizations at any time. No visitors will be permitted in the area involved. Any barracks from which several cases are reported will be quarantined. Its occupants will not be permitted to mingle in any way with the occupants of other barracks in the same organization. Guards enforced the orders strictly. But people infected with influenza can infect others before they feel any symptoms. It was already too late. Within 48 hours, every organization in the camp was affected. The next day, hospital admissions rose to 194, the next 371, the next 492. 4 days after the first officer reported sick, the first soldier died. The next day, two more men died, and 711 soldiers were admitted to the hospital. In 6 days, the hospital went from 610 occupied beds to 4,102 occupied, almost five times more patients than it had ever cared for. There were too few ambulances to carry the sick to the hospital, so mules pulled ambulance carts until the mules, exhausted, stopped working. There were too few sheets for the beds, so the Red Cross ordered 6,000 from Chicago. There were too few beds, so several thousand cots were crammed into every square inch of corridor, storage area, meeting room, office, and veranda. It wasn't enough. Early on, the medical detachment members had moved into tents so their own barracks could be transformed into a 500-bed, or cot, hospital. 10 barracks scattered throughout the camp were also converted into hospitals. It still wasn't enough. All training for war, for killing, ceased. Now men fought to stop the killing. Healthy soldiers were consumed with attending, in one way or another, the sick. 320 men were sent to the hospital as general support staff, then 260 more were added. Another 250 men did nothing but stuff sacks with straw to make mattresses. Several hundred others unloaded a stream of railroad cars full of medical supplies. Hundreds more helped transport the sick or cleaned laundry, washing sheets, making masks, or prepared food. Meanwhile, barely in advance of a threatening thunderstorm, 100 carpenters worked to enclose 39 verandas with roofing paper to keep the rain off the hundreds of patients exposed to the elements. The gauze masks Caps was so proud of, the masks Welch had praised, were no longer being made. Caps ran out of material and personnel to make them. The medical staff itself was collapsing from overwork and disease. 5 days into the epidemic, 5 physicians, 35 nurses, and 50 orderlies were sick. That number would grow, and the medical staff would have its own death toll. 7 days into the epidemic, soldiers still capable of work converted 9 more barracks into hospitals. There were shortages of aspirin, atropine, digitalis, glacial acetic acid, a disinfectant, paper bags, sputum cups, and thermometers. And thermometers that were available were being broken by men in delirium. 40 more nurses arrived for the emergency, giving the hospital 383. It needed still more. All visitors to the base, and especially to the hospital, had already been prohibited except under extraordinary circumstances. Now those extraordinary circumstances had become common, with visitors pouring in, Mikey noted, summoned by danger of death telegrams. 438 telegrams had been handled the day before. That number was still climbing, and rapidly. To handle what soon became thousands of telegrams and phone calls each day, the Red Cross erected a large tent, floored, heated, wired for electricity, with its own telephone exchange and rows of chairs that resembled an auditorium where relatives waited to see desperately ill soldiers. More personnel were needed to escort these visitors to the sick. More personnel and more laundry facilities were needed just to wash the gown and mask that every visitor donned. The hospital staff could not keep pace. Endless rows of men coughing, lying in blood-stained linen, surrounded by flies. Orders were issued that formalin should be added to each sputum cup to keep the flies away. And the grotesque smells of vomit, urine, and feces made the relatives in some ways more desperate than the patients. They offered bribes to whoever seemed healthy, doctor, nurse, or orderly, to ensure care for their sons and lovers. Indeed, visitors begged them to accept bribes. Mikey responded sternly, "Devoting special personal care to any one patient whose condition is not critical is prohibited, and the ward personnel is instructed to report any civilian or other person to the commanding officer who makes a special request that a certain patient be given special attention." And there was something else. Something still worse. The same day that the first Camp Grant soldier died, 3,108 troops boarded a train leaving there for Camp Hancock outside Augusta, Georgia. They left as a civilian health official several hundred miles away from Camp Grant demanded the quarantine of the entire camp, demanded that even escorts of the dead home be prohibited. They left with the memory of the trains carrying troops infected with measles, when Gorgas and Vaughn had protested uselessly that troops had distributed its seeds at the encampment and on the train. No power on earth could stop the spread of measles under these conditions. They left after the provost general had had the foresight to cancel the next draft. And they left after Gorgas's office had urged that all movement of troops between infected and uninfected camps cease. The Army did order no transfer of any influenza contacts between camps or to bases under quarantine. But even that order came days later, at a time when each day's delay could cost literally thousands of lives. And the order also stated that movements of officers and men, not contacts, will be affected promptly as ordered. Yet men could appear healthy while incubating influenza themselves, and they could also infect others before symptoms appeared. The men leaving Grant on that train were jammed into the cars with little room to move about, layered and stacked as tightly as if on a submarine as they moved deliberately across 950 miles of the country. They would have been excited at first, for movement creates its own excitement. And then tedium would have set in, the minutes dragging out, the hours melding the passage into a self-contained world 10 feet across and 7 feet high, smelling of cigarette smoke and sweat, with hundreds of men in each car in far closer quarters than in any barracks, and with far less ventilation. As the country rolled by, men would have leaned out windows to suck in a wisp of air the way they sucked on cigarettes. And then one soldier would have broken into a coughing fit. Another would have begun pouring out sweat. Another would have suddenly had blood pouring out of his nose. Other men would have shrunk from them in fear, and then still others would have collapsed or erupted in fever or delirium or begun bleeding from their nose or possibly their ears. The train would have filled with panic. At stops for refueling and watering, men would have poured out of the train seeking any escape, mixed with workers and other civilians, obeyed reluctantly when officers ordered them back into the cars, into this rolling coffin. When the train arrived, over 700 men, nearly one quarter of all the troops on the train, were taken directly to the base hospital, quickly followed by hundreds more. In total, 2,000 of the 3,108 troops would be hospitalized with influenza. After 143 deaths among them, the statistics merged into those of other troops from Camp Hancock. Hancock, to which this shipment of virus was sent, and became impossible to track. But it is likely that the death toll approached, and possibly exceeded, 10% of all the troops on the train. Hagedorn had become all but irrelevant to the running of the camp. Now he yielded on every point to the medical personnel, did everything they asked, made every resource available to them. Nothing seemed even to slow the disease. On October 4th, for the first time, more than 100 men at Camp Grant died in a single day. Nearly 5,000 were ill, with hundreds more falling ill each day. And the graph of contagion still pointed nearly straight up. Soon, in a single day, 1,810 soldiers would report ill. At some other army camps, even more soldiers would collapse almost simultaneously. Indeed, at Camp Custer outside Battle Creek, Michigan, 2,800 troops would report ill in a single day. Before the epidemic, CAPS had begun testing Preston Kise's pneumonia serum, prepared from chickens. Kise had reasoned that since chickens were not susceptible to the pneumococcus, infecting them with highly virulent pneumococci might produce a very powerful serum. CAPS had planned a series of very carefully controlled experiments. But now, with nothing else to try, he administered the serum to all as it arrived. It was in short supply. It seemed to work. 234 men suffering from pneumonia received the serum. Only 16.7% died, while more than half of those who did not receive it died. But it was in short supply. Desperate efforts were being made to protect troops from the disease, or at least prevent complications. Germicidal solutions were sprayed into the mouths and noses of troops. Soldiers were ordered to use germicidal mouthwash and to gargle twice a day. Iodine in glycerin was tried in an attempt to disinfect mouths. Vaseline containing menthol was used in nasal passages, mouths washed with liquid abilene. Despite every effort, the death toll kept rising. It rose so high that staff grew weary, weary of paperwork, weary even of identifying the dead. Mikey was forced to issue orders warning, "The remains are labeled by placing an adhesive plaster bearing the name, rank, organization around the middle of the left forearm. It is the duty of the ward surgeon to see that this is done before the remains leave the ward. A great deal of difficulty has been experienced in reading names on death certificates. Either have these certificates typewritten or plainly printed. Any neglect on the part of responsible persons will be interpreted as a neglect of duty." Mikey also instructed all personnel, "The relatives and friends of persons dying at this hospital must not be sent to the base hospital morgue. The handling of the effects of the deceased has grown into an enormous task." Simultaneously, in that important fight to sustain the country's morale, the Chicago Tribune reported good news from Camp Grant. "Epidemic broken," blared the paper's headlines. "The small army of expert workers under the command of Lieutenant Colonel H.C. Mikey has battled the pneumonia epidemic to a standstill. Deaths occurred among the pneumonia patients, but more than 100 fighting men pulled through the crisis of their illness. 175 patients have been released after winning their fight." At that point, Grant's death toll was 452. It showed no sign of slowing. Hoping to have some slight effect on it, hoping to prevent cross-infections, Mikey and Caps reiterated their orders to place patients outside. The crowding of patients in the wards must be reduced to the minimum. The verandas must be used to the greatest advantage. Perhaps that reminded Hagedorn of his earlier order authorizing overcrowding. Perhaps then, too, he got word of the hundreds of young men who had died on the train to Georgia, which, like the barracks overcrowding, he had ordered because of military necessity. Perhaps these things caused him such personal pain that it explained why he abruptly ordered the withholding of the names of all soldiers who died from influenza. Perhaps somehow that allowed him to block the deaths from his mind. A day later, the death toll at the camp broke 500, with thousands more still desperately ill. How far the pandemic will spread will apparently depend only upon the material which it can feed upon, wrote one army physician. It is too early to foretell the end or to measure the damage which will be done before the pandemic disappears. Many of the dead were more boys than men. 18 years old, 19 years old, 20 years old, 21 years old. Boys filled with their lithe youth and sly smiles. Hagedorn, the bachelor, had made the army his home, his soldiers his family, the young men about him his life. On October 8th, Mikey reported the latest death toll to Colonel Hagedorn in his headquarters office. The colonel heard the report, nodded, and after an awkward moment, Mikey rose to leave. Hagedorn told him to close the door. Death was all about him, in the papers on his desk, in the reports he heard, literally in the air he breathed. It was an envelope sealing him in. He picked up his phone and ordered his sergeant to leave the building and take with him all personnel in the headquarters and stand for inspection outside. It was a bizarre order. The sergeant informed Captain Jisson and Lieutenant Rochelle. They were puzzled, but complied. For half an hour, they waited. The pistol shot, even from inside the building, came as a loud report. Hagedorn was not listed as a casualty of the epidemic, nor did his sacrifice stop it. Chapter 19. 2 days after Philadelphia's Liberty Loan Parade, Wilmer Crewson had issued that somber statement that the epidemic in the civilian population was assuming the type found in naval stations and cantonments. Influenza was indeed exploding in the city. Within 72 hours after the parade, every single bed in each of the city's 31 hospitals was filled, and people began dying. Hospitals began refusing to accept patients, with nurses turning down $100 bribes without a doctor's or a police order. Yet people queued up to get in. One woman remembered her neighbors going to the closest hospital, the Pennsylvania Hospital at 5th and Lombard, but when they got there, there were lines and no doctors available and no medicine available. So they went home, those that were strong enough. Medical care was making little difference anyway. Mary Tullidge, daughter of Dr. George Tullidge, died 24 hours after her first symptoms. Alice Wolowitz, a student nurse at Mount Sinai Hospital, began her shift in the morning, felt sick, and was dead 12 hours later. On October 1st, the third day after the parade, the epidemic killed more than 100 people, 117 in a single day. That number would double, triple, quadruple, quintuple, sextuple. Soon the daily death toll from influenza alone would exceed the city's average weekly death toll from all causes, all illnesses, all accidents, all criminal acts combined. On October 3rd, only 5 days after Crewson had let the parade proceed, he banned all public meetings in the city, including, finally, further Liberty Loan gatherings, and closed all churches, schools, theaters. Even public funerals were prohibited. Only one public gathering place was allowed to remain open. The saloon, the key constituency of the Vare machine. The next day, the state health commissioner closed them. The first temporary facility to care for the sick was set up at Holmesburg, the city's poorhouse. It was called Emergency Hospital No. 1. The Board of Health knew more would follow. Its 500 beds were filled in a day. Ultimately, there would be 12 similar large hospitals run with city help, three of them located in converted Republican clubs in South Philadelphia. It was where people had always gone for help. In 10 days, the epidemic had exploded from a few hundred civilian cases and one or two deaths a day to hundreds of thousands ill and hundreds of deaths each day. Federal, municipal, and state courts closed. Giant placards everywhere warned the public to avoid crowds and use handkerchiefs when sneezing or coughing. Other placards read, "Spitting equals death." People who spat on the street were arrested, 60 in a single day. The newspapers reported the arrests, even while continuing to minimize the epidemic. Physicians were themselves dying, 3 one day, 2 another, 4 the next. The newspapers reported those deaths, on inside pages with other obituaries, even while continuing to minimize the epidemic. Health and city workers wore masks constantly. What should I do? People wondered with dread. How long will it go on? Each day people discovered that friends and neighbors who had been perfectly healthy a week or a day earlier were dead. And city authorities and newspapers continued to minimize the danger. The public ledger claimed nonsensically that Crewson's order banning all public gatherings was not a public health measure and reiterated there is no cause for panic or alarm. On October 5th, doctors reported that 254 people died that day from the epidemic, and the papers quoted public health authorities as saying, "The peak of the influenza epidemic has been reached." When 289 Philadelphians died the next day, the papers said, "Believing that the peak of the epidemic has passed, health officials are confident." In each of the next 2 days, more than 300 people died, and again, Crewson announced, "These deaths mark the high water mark in the fatalities, and it is fair to assume that from this time until the epidemic is crushed, the death rate will constantly be lowered." The next day, 428 people died, and the daily death toll would keep climbing for many days yet, approaching double even that figure. Crewson said, "Don't get frightened or panic-stricken over exaggerated reports." But Crewson's reassurances no longer reassured. One could not listen to Paul Lewis speak on any subject and not sense the depth of his knowledge and his ability to see into a problem, envision possible solutions, and understand their ramifications. Other scientists in the city did not defer to him, but they looked to him. He had been working on this problem for 3 weeks now. He hardly ever left his laboratory, nor did his assistants, except for the ones who fell ill. Every scientist in Philadelphia was spending every waking minute in the laboratory as well. The laboratory was his favorite place anyway, more even than home. Normally, everything in his work gave him peace. The laboratory gave him peace, including the mysteries that he embraced. He settled into them like a man casting off into an impenetrable ocean fog, a fog that made one feel both alone in and part of the world. But this work did not give him peace. It wasn't the pressure, exactly. It was that the pressure forced him off rhythm, forced him to abandon the scientific process. He developed a hypothesis and focused on it, but the shorthand process by which he arrived at it made him uncomfortable. So did hearing the news of the deaths. The youth and vitality and promise of the dead horrified. The waste of their promise horrified. He worked harder. Arthur Isinger, president and honor man of Penn's class of 1918, died. Dudley Perkins, a Swarthmore football hero, died. Nearly two-thirds of the dead were under 40. It was a common practice in 1918 for people to hang a piece of crepe on the door to mark a death in the house. There was crepe everywhere. If it was a young person, they'd put a white crepe at the door, recalled Anna Milani. If it was a middle-aged person, they'd put a black crepe, and if it was an elderly one, they put a gray crepe at the door, signifying who died. We were children, and we were excited to find out who died next, and we were looking at the door. There was another crepe and another door. There was always another door. People were dying like flies, Clifford Adams said. On Spring Garden Street, looked like every other house had crepe over the door. People was dead there. Anna Lavin was at Mount Sinai Hospital. My uncle died there. My aunt died first. Their son was 13. A lot of young people, just married. They were the first to die. But the most terrifying aspect of the epidemic was the piling up of bodies. Undertakers, themselves sick, were overwhelmed. They had no place to put bodies. Gravediggers either were sick or refused to bury influenza victims. The director of the city jail offered to have prisoners